In that case, what prompts the change from champion to tyrant? Isn't it pretty obvious that it happens when the champion of the people starts acting like the character in the story about the temple of Zeus, the wolf god in Arcadia? What story? He asked. That there is one piece of human innards chopped up among all the pieces of the other sacrificial offerings, and that anyone who tastes it will inevitably turn into a wolf. Or haven't you heard that story?
Yes, I have heard it.
Isn't it the same with a champion of the people? Once he really wins the mob over, the blood of his kinsmen is no bar to him. He accuses someone falsely, as such people do. He brings him to trial and murders him, and as he rubs out a man's life, his unholy mouth and lips taste the blood of a butchered kinsman. He drives people into exile or kills them, hinting at a cancellation of debts and the redistribution of land. What is the inevitable and predestined next step for someone like this? Doesn't he either have to be destroyed by his enemies or else become tyrant, turning from man into wolf?
Yes, that is absolutely inevitable, he said.
He becomes the architect of civil war against those who own property.
He does.
Well then, if he's sent into exile but returns despite his enemies, doesn't he return as an out-and-out tyrant?
Yes, obviously.
And if his enemies are unable to drive him into exile or kill him by attacking him publicly, then they start plotting to kill him secretly, by assassination.
Yes, that's certainly what tends to happen, he said.
The tyrant's response to this is the famous request which everyone who has reached this stage discovers. He asks the people for a personal bodyguard to guarantee the safety of their people's champion.
Indeed, he does.
And they give him one. More worried about his safety than their own, presumably.
Much more.
Shall we then describe the happiness of this man and of the city where such a creature comes into being?
By all means, let's describe it, he said.
Very well. To start with, in the early days, doesn't he have a smile and a friendly word for everyone he meets? He says he's no tyrant and is full of promises both to individuals and to the state. Won't he have freed them from their debts and divided up the land among the people and among his supporters? Doesn't he pretend to be universally kind and gentle?
He's bound to.
But I imagine that once he feels safe from his enemies in exile, being reconciled with some and destroying others, his first concern is to be constantly starting wars, so that the people will stand in need of a leader.
Very likely.
And, perhaps, with the further intention that their contributions to the war will impoverish them, compel them to concentrate on their daily occupations, and make them less likely to plot against him.
Undoubtedly.
And if there are some independent-minded people whom he suspects of challenging his rule, doesn't he try to find a good excuse for handing them over to the enemy and destroying them? For all these reasons, isn't a tyrant always bound to be stirring up war?
Yes, he is.
Doesn't this tend to make him increasingly unpopular with the citizens?
Of course it does.
Then the boldest of those who helped to make him tyrant, and who are now in positions of power, start to speak their minds freely, don't they? Both to him and to one another, criticising what is going on.
Probably.
So the tyrant, if he wants to go on ruling, must be prepared to remove all these people until he is left with no one who is any use, whether friend or enemy.
Obviously he must.
He will need a sharp pair of eyes then. He needs to pick out the brave, the noble, the wise, and the rich, since it is his unavoidable good fortune, whether he likes it or not, to be the enemy of all of them. He must plot their downfall until he has got the city clean.
A fine way to clean a city, he said.
Yes, the exact opposite of what doctors do to the body. They remove what is worst and leave what is best. With the tyrant, it is the other way round.
That's what he has to do, apparently, if he is to go on ruling.
In which case, I said, he is firmly and inevitably impaled on the horns of a delightful dilemma, which requires him either to spend his life with the worthless mob and be hated by them into the bargain, or not to live at all. "That's about the size of it," he said. "And the more hated by the citizens his behaviour makes him, the larger and more reliable a bodyguard he will need, won't he?" "Of course." "Who are these reliable people, then? Where can he send to for them?" "They'll come winging their way of their own accord," he said. "Any number of them, as long as he pays the going rate."
Dog's teeth. Drones again. Foreign ones, all kinds of them, I think you're talking about.
Good. I haven't given you the wrong impression, then.
And from the city itself, might he not bring himself...
to do what?
To deprive the citizens of their slaves, set the slaves free, and make them part of his bodyguard?
Indeed he might. They are, after all, the most reliable he can find.
"What a wonderful thing you make a tyrant out to be," I said, "if these are the people he has as his friends, the people he can trust, once he has destroyed the friends he started with."
"Well, these certainly are the kind of friends he has."
"So, while he enjoys the admiration of these friends and the company of these new citizens, do decent people hate him and avoid him? How can they help doing so?" "We have strayed from the point, however," I said. "Let's return to that army the tyrant has, that fine, large, varied and ever-changing army, and ask how it is going to be maintained."
"Well, obviously, if there's money in the city's temples, then as long as it lasts, he will spend that, plus the money of his victims, allowing him to exact smaller contributions from the people. But what happens when these run out? He will use his father's money, obviously, to support himself, his drinking companions, and his male and female friends."
"I see. You mean the people who spawned the tyrant will support him and his friends?"
"It will have no choice," he said.
"What if the people resent this?" I asked. "It is not right," they might say for a start, "for a grown-up son to be supported by his father. Quite the reverse, in fact. A father should be supported by his son. What is more, the reason we fathered you and put you in power was not so that we could ourselves become slaves to our own slaves as soon as you became powerful and support you and them and the rest of your collection of human flotsam. We order you to leave the city now, you and your friends." "What do you think would happen then?"
"My God," he said. "Then the people really will find out what they are and what kind of offspring they have fathered, taken to their hearts and allowed to grow."
"What do you mean?" I asked. "Will the tyrant use force against his parent? Will he beat him if he disobeys?"
"Yes, once he has taken away his weapons."
"A parricide, then, this tyrant you are describing, a cruel guardian for man's old age. At this point, it seems, the thing is an acknowledged tyranny. The people have jumped out of the proverbial frying pan into the fire, from their enslavement to free men, to a despotism of slaves."
"Yes, that is how it happens."
"Will there be any objection, then," I asked, "to our saying that we have given an adequate description of the way tyranny evolves out of democracy, and of what it is like when it has done so?"
"No," he said. "Our description is perfectly adequate."